Welcome to Vegetarian Stew, a radio show that hopes to stir up your consciousness about food, about your food choices, and how food choices affect our health, the lives of animals, and our environment. This radio program hopes to stir together spicy ideas with a dash of creative thinking and to help us all to live more consciously, creatively, and compassionately. Now, before I ask Joe what's cooking, I want to remind our radio audience that the views expressed during the course of this program are the views of the presenter and not necessarily those of KAFM or its affiliates or associates. Here again in the radio station, we've got Marion at the board.
Hello.
And we have Joe, the main man.
Good afternoon.
And myself, Carol. Joe, what's cooking today?
Today, we are very pleased to have once again as our guest, Colleen Patrick Goudreau. Colleen is the founder of Compassionate Cooks, a nonprofit organization devoted to empowering people to make informed food choices and to educating them about the delicious and healthy joys of vegetarianism and veganism. Colleen became a vegetarian and then a vegan when she learned the conditions under which animals are raised for human consumption. Colleen holds a master's degree in English literature and is self-trained as a cook. She conducts monthly high-energy cooking classes and has recently produced a professional vegetarian cooking DVD, which you can obtain through her website. Colleen, welcome to Vegetarian Stew.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me back again.
You should feel very honored. We don't have many people back twice, Colleen.
Feel honored. Thank you.
And we're doubly honored also. Joe's got some mighty tough questions for you, so let's fire away, Joe, because I think we've got a full agenda today.
Well, I don't think we can stump Colleen here. And we're not even going to try.
Good. Thank you.
Colleen, let's talk about culturally based perceptions of non-human animals. Most people think of themselves as kind and caring people, but they do not consider the meat on their plate as an animal that they are responsible for killing. What are the veils that people use to prevent this confrontation?
Yeah, big question.
It's heavy duty, yeah.
There's so many. I mean, you know, the consumption of animals in our society is so prevalent, and it's something we're taught from the very beginning. It's something we're taught from the time we're just born, especially if our parents hold those notions. So, I mean, from the very moment we're born, we're taught to compartmentalize animals, and, you know, some go in the box that say eating, some go in the box that say petting, some go in the box that say entertain us. And it's no wonder that we just see the bodies on our plates as completely removed from the whole animal. I liken the process of coming out of that to an awakening. And so I liken the experience of that cultural denial that they're not animals, they're not body parts, to being asleep, which is a much, you know, it's a much more realistic and it's a much kinder way of perceiving this experience. I don't believe we're cruel. I believe we're sleeping because everything points to supporting that. Everybody, the advertising, the industries, you know, our friends, our family, and so it's no surprise that we just don't see those things for what they really are. Our language reflects that as well, and it's very, very powerful. I think it's really ironic that we often refer to, you know, herd animals, and we say, oh, they're just acting like a bunch of sheep, and they're just acting like a bunch of cattle. I think really it would be more accurate to say they're acting like a bunch of humans. I think people are really afraid to express their individuality. They're really afraid to appear different. They're afraid to speak up for what they believe in, and I think this is a big part of why people, some people are able to do it very easily, and some people are afraid to, and that's why I think it's important to know like-minded people and to have like-minded people to feel supported and to have people that reflect your ideals and values.
Everybody's different, and everybody reacts differently to different events happening in their life. I like the analogy of sleep, and in fact, I think of it maybe as sleepwalking, mm-hmm. because we've been lulled from birth into into this dreamlike state where we don't always recognize things that should be apparent.
Now, Joe, in the phrasing of your question, you said something about that the person is responsible for killing. Don't you think that's a little, or Colleen, do you think that's a little bit strong to say that if I choose to eat a steak, I'm personally responsible for killing the cow?
Well, that's a big question, too, right? You know, where's the line? I mean, where's the personal responsibility in something like that? I think we're all responsible. I think we're responsible for every choice we make. We're responsible for every purchase we make, and it's up to us to know, especially when we do know there might be things involved that we wouldn't do ourselves. And as we learn, I think we make better choices. I often quote Julia Butterfly Hill, who was asked in an interview, so, you know, you really think people can make a difference? You really think people can make a difference? And she said, no, I don't think people can make a difference. I think people do make a difference. And I think that's the bottom line. We make a difference in every choice we make. And so I do think we all have the blood on our hands because we know that an animal has to be killed in order to put that steak on our plate. And we pay someone else to do the killing that most of us would not do ourselves.
Yeah, I agree, and recently I was lucky enough to see a film. In fact, Marion and I both saw it here in Grand Junction called, what was the name of that?
Fast Food Nation.
There you go, Fast Food Nation. And that that dealt with that whole issue of having others do the dirty work for you. A great film. Colleen, you alluded to some of this already. How does everyday language and how do common figures of speech that we use all the time, how do they reinforce human perceptions of the beings that we call animals?
Mm-hmm. I'd love to do a whole show on this. I'd love to do a book on this because I think this is so, so interesting.
Well, fire away.
I'll say a few things. I mean, we do, again, remove the animal from the body parts that are on our plate, but it's very interesting that we can do certain things. I mean, there's certain words that we use. We can say beef and bacon and sausage and hamburger and meatball and meatloaf and ground beef and veal and chuck and all of these things that, you know, have no resemblance to an animal whatsoever. And, I mean, it's very interesting that we drive down the street and on the side of the road there might be a dead animal and we say there's a carcass or there's a corpse, but the dead animal on our plate, we say it's dinner, or we say it's filet mignon. And if someone were to say that that's a dead animal or a corpse or a carcass,
roadkill.
Right, but even if someone were to refer to that on your plate as roadkill or a carcass or a dead animal, someone would say that you're being very offensive. And it is offensive because it's offending that person's veil, that person's denial. So I think it's interesting that we use those words. In some ways, though, so, you know, it separates the animal from the thing. And in some ways, I think it's interesting that we can say certain animals. So we can say a chicken leg, and we can say turkey breast. But if I were to say to you, you know, if I were to say to you, do you eat chicken? You wouldn't think anything of it, and you'd say no, probably. But if I were to say, do you eat chickens? Plural, like chickens? Do
plural.
You eat chickens? It kind of pulls you out of what we're used to hearing, and you'd say, chickens, well, do you eat turkeys? You know, well, it's almost different.
It creates an image there in your mind, doesn't it, of a bunch of chickens running through the barnyard. Maybe.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It kind of puts the animal back into that thing. So I think that's really interesting. And one word that I feel very strongly about people saying, saying exactly what it is the word milk. And I feel so strongly about this because the dairy industry wants to own this word, and they actually have sued soy milk, soy beverage, soy milk industries, companies for using the word because they believe they have sole ownership to that word.
And how could they possibly own that word?
It's amazing. They think they do. And look, I mean, our culture supports it, right? If you just say milk, people just assume you're talking about cow's milk. But I don't know. You might be talking about hyena's milk. You might be talking about human milk. I don't know what you're drinking. These
coconut
days we're told
milk.
To drink every, you know, goats and sheep and cow's milk. So it's really important, I think, to call it what it is. It's cow's milk as opposed to goat's milk, as opposed to hyena milk or lion's milk. And call the beverages that we are drinking, I really abhor the use of the words fake and substitute. substitute and imitation and alternative. I hate these words because we're talking about plant foods that we don't need another word to feel better about eating. We don't have to call plant foods anything other than what they are, like we do in the case of meat, to eat them. So when we're talking about that milk, let's say almond milk, let's say non-dairy milk, let's say soy milk or oat milk or whatever it is, let's use the language that actually reflects exactly what we're doing, because I think part of it is when we use the language, it enforces that sleep, it keeps us asleep, and if someone pulls us out of it, then we might see for the first time what it really is, and that's why I really encourage vegans or people who already have the animal consciousness to do that and not be afraid of upsetting the person next to you. I'm not saying be offensive. I'm just saying speak the truth. If that's cow's milk they're drinking, call it cow's milk.
With a smile on your face.
With
right,
a smile on your face.
You're not going to say bovine mammary secretions.
I might.
It is, right?
I might say that.
What it is.
So if they're eating a hamburger, we should tell them what they're eating?
Well, I think let's call it what it is, sure. And you know, and I really do think humor plays a big role in all of this. I really do think with a smile on your face. I really do think, you know, kind of nudging someone and saying, well, it's not a hammer, it's a ground-up cow, you know. I mean, I've done it, and I see how people respond. And if you're doing it in such a way that doesn't make them feel, I mean, you're not doing it to make them feel put off, though they might. That's still not yours. It's not mine. If I say something that someone finds offensive, it's not mine. I'm not doing it to be offensive. I'm doing it to be truthful. And if they don't like it, then I think a lot of it has to do with it, me acting as a mirror for what they're not comfortable
right.
with.
I agree. I have a friend, a neighbor actually across the street, who teases me because he's a big carnivore. And he teases me about my diet. And he says, well, actually, we're eating more fish now. And I said, well, I hope you like lots of mercury in your meal.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And even he sort of had a smile about that
right.
one. Although I think he also winced at the same time.
Well, and I have to say, Joe, too, I actually don't like the use of the word carnivore to refer to people who eat animals because we're not true carnivores. Because, you know, when you said that, I thought, like, a lion was living across the street from me. I wasn't
Nah, he's just a lamb, actually.
What do you mean we're not true carnivores?
Well, in the sense that we don't resemble the carnivorous animals when you look at our physiology compared to herbivorous animals and carnivorous animals. We resemble herbivorous animals. And in the sense that we're not true carnivores, in the sense that we could survive, obviously, we do survive without meat, whereas a lion or true carnivores cannot survive without consuming other animals. We're capable of it in that our digestive system can do it, but we're not doing a very good job.
Colleen, it's a good point. And, you know, for example, lions and other true carnivores, they have very short intestinal tracts, and that's so they can get that meat out of their system before it really goes bad inside
exactly.
of them. And we have very long intestinal tracts as humans, and plus our teeth aren't designed for it, obviously, either. You know, with the teeth we have, we'd be really hard put to take down a gazelle or something like that and bite into its neck. I mean, it just wouldn't work. So
exactly.
Point
and even
well
in terms
taken.
Of even in terms of, you know, if you've ever had a cat, if you ever lived with a cat and you saw how they react when they see their prey, we don't act like that when we see cows. We don't start salivating and we don't start shaking and we don't start stalking our prey. That's just not what happens. Big difference.
Oh, no, I just wanted to hear what...
I thought you were tapping me to see if I was awake here.
Oh, well, I was kind of looking at one of the questions that Joe had and was kind of intriguing me about how... in fact, Joe sent me a cartoon via email yesterday where it showed an American hugging the cat and the dog and saying how much they love them. And then there were pigs and cows that were being boxed for the slaughter. And I was just kind of wondering... I guess it's culturally how a culture decides which animals are pets worthy of love and which are going to be sent to the slaughterhouse. Because, like, I don't know, a pig is supposed to be a very loving animal and can be a wonderful pet, and yet we in America choose to eat it. It's kind of, I'm not exactly sure what my question is, but it's kind of a thought that interests me. Well, phrase my question then, Joe.
Let's see. Let me boil that down here.
Which do you pet and which do you eat?
How about this one, Colleen? In certain cultures, dogs and cats are raised to be eaten and are even considered to be delicacies. Most Americans are very uncomfortable and disgusted with this practice, and yet eagerly look forward to their lunch of chicken flesh or pig flesh or cow flesh. Why the difference?
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's really interesting, and it's another reason why the idea that we're supposed to consume animals is just balderdash from a physiological standpoint. But from a cultural standpoint, it stands because we've decided in this culture that pigs and cows and calves and chickens and ducks and lambs and turkeys are all edible. But when we hear about people, even in our own culture, eating deer, you know, or even eating rabbit or buffalo, you know, we get upset. And then we get upset when we hear about people eating horses and goats, again, in kind of the Western culture. But then when we hear about people eating frog legs or chicken's feet or cow's tongues, we get really disgusted. Like there's a difference between eating the foot versus the leg. I mean, it's all, you know, still the part of an animal, still a body part. And then we really do turn our noses up and we have scorn almost for people who eat dogs and cats. And it's because here in this culture, we love our dogs and cats, but in other cultures, they might also love their dogs and cats, but they're also eating them. And we draw that arbitrary line. It's that box I was talking about before. And we decide that certain animals are here for our enjoyment, certain animals are here for loving, and certain animals are here for our gustatory pleasure. And I think the bottom line is when you look at it from the animal's perspective, to them it's all the same. You know, there's no difference. You know, a Korean dog wants to live as much and resist death as much as an American duck. To the animals, it's all the same. But we're the ones who draw those lines, and they all have the same capacity for feeling pain and for suffering.
And they're all striving consciously and unconsciously just for the same things that we are, essentially, and that is just being alive and being free and going about their business and raising their families and that sort of
thing.
Well,
there you get into philosophical points of view. Do animals have souls? Do they have consciousness? Do they have reasoning? And I suppose you can be arguing that forever.
Well, I don't think they need to have a soul necessarily to strive for happiness and freedom from pain and satisfying their hunger. You could argue about soul all you want. You could do the same for human beings and argue about souls. But I don't think that's really the point.
It kind of all boils down to the question is not can they think or such or speak, but can they feel? And you know,
can they suffer?
Oh, there's no doubt. Yeah. Well, Colleen, what do you feel about can animals suffer? How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I think like what Joe said. I mean, the bottom line is, if an animal has wings, they should be able to fly. If they have legs, they should be able to walk. If they have a life, they should be able to live it out.
Yeah.
And
well
I think
put.
Once we start stepping in, that's when we change the question. So regardless of them having a soul, they should at least have the right to just live. If they have a life.
Otherwise, we start putting ourselves in the position of God there, don't we?
Well, we already do. I mean, the thing is, too, one of the excuses people use about, you know, when they start asking those absurd questions about stopping eating animals, they say, well, we'd be overrun if we stopped eating all the animals. Well, we have to stop breeding the animals, first of all. I mean, we are breeding billions of animals only to kill them. And if that's not just a horrific thought, I mean, we're just there being born just so they can be killed. And it's so hard to wrap my brain around the billions and billions of animals that we say we care about, and we say we care about life, and we say life is sacred, and we're bringing them into this world only to kill them.
Colleen, a friend of mine, who I don't see too often because he lives in another state, but a friend of mine who is a practicing member of a major religious organization once told me that over the eons, man has clawed and scratched his way to the top of the food chain. And so, therefore, any talk of abandoning our carnivorous ways, I know you don't like that word, would be turning our backs on our evolutionary history. Now, what do you make of this argument?
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. It's one of the excuses people use to justify the consumption of non-human animals. And, you know, people often fall back on science and religion when they're kind of at a loss for their own personal excuses. And I'm not insulting anybody. We all do have these excuses. I had them, too, when I was consuming animals. The first thing I hear when you say that is that when we use the word food chain, that phrase food chain always throws me because, well, first of all, food web would be a much more accurate description. But last time I looked, predatory animals were here before humans were, which means that we were food for them. And I never hear anybody talk about predatory animals being at the top of the food chain. The other thing that I find so ludicrous about the claim that vegetarians are denying their evolutionary history, their evolutionary heritage. I've heard that before. Michael Pollan in The Omnivore's Excuses, I mean, The Omnivore's Dilemma, talks about that very thing that vegetarians are turning their back on that. You know, evolution, it's a biological process. It's an amoral biological process that Darwin posed. And we use this amoral process to justify our actions, which I think is just, it's ludicrous. Evolution is not a system of morals, and in no other aspect of our lives do we use evolution to justify our behavior. You know, on one hand, it's really interesting, because on one hand, we say that we're superior to other animals because we have the ability to be more than just instincts. Now, I'm not saying that other animals are just balls of instinct, but we accuse them of that. We say that we have the ability to make moral decisions. And that's what separates us from other other animals. And then we turn around and we say, but evolution dictates that we have to eat animals. We totally contradict ourselves. We have the ability and the responsibility, in my opinion, to make moral and rational decisions, not abdicate our ethics to a mindless, literally an amoral process. And it just denies every aspect of what makes us rational, compassionate, moral creatures. We're not forced to obey the dictates of evolution. We don't obey the dictates of evolution in our daily lives when we drive cars or fly in planes or, you know, sit in front of computers all day. And so, you know, we take Darwin's theory and make it a substitute for morality.
When you say amoral, as you mentioned earlier, you're talking about evolutionary theory being neither moral nor immoral.
Exactly.
It's kind of a neutral thing.
Exactly.
I'd like to remind our radio audience that we're talking, our guest today is Colleen Patrick O'Drew, who is the founder of Compassionate Cooks. And before we forget, Colleen, what is your website so folks who want to get more information about your organization and about your books and about your educational, could you give that to me, please?
Sure, thank you. It's CompassionateCooks.com, www.CompassionateCooks.com.
And there's no space between the word compassionate or cooks, is that correct? Okie doke, folks. Okay, Joe, sorry to interrupt you, but we wanted to...
No, that's fine.
Yeah.
Evolutionary process, then, is neither moral nor immoral. Now, you were talking about people that would use the... turning our backs on the evolutionary process. If we stopped eating meat, for example, and stopped eating animals and their products. But the other side of the coin is that we get away from the evolutionary process, as you pointed out, in so many activities. Mm-hmm. And then when you think of child labor and slavery and all the other things which you could argue were part of the evolutionary process or not, but we don't do them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the people that make that argument are essentially trying to have it both ways then, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, just because we can do something doesn't mean we should, right? I mean, we're all capable of killing one another. That doesn't mean we should. You know, we're capable of consuming animals. But that doesn't mean we should, and that doesn't mean we have to. So it's just another excuse. I mean, it really just comes down to it being another excuse. It's really, I think, for me, the last one that people finally use because they have nothing else. Because nothing else works.
Colleen, are you a fan of Benjamin Franklin?
Who isn't? Come on, Joe.
There's a great story. I read his biography. There's a great story that he tells about on a voyage, a sailing voyage to England, which he made a few of, and it took about 30 days to cross the ocean. So he's on board. He was experimenting, as he was prone to do. He was experimenting with being a vegetarian at the time. And so he's on board ship, and the ship's moving along. And suddenly the winds died down, and so the sails dropped and the ship stopped moving. And so they were in a lull there, and they needed to pass the time. So the sailors on board the ship decided to throw a few lines overboard and see if they could catch some fish. So, in fact, they did. And Benjamin Franklin's observing this whole thing. There's a point to this story, by the way. Benjamin Franklin's observing this whole thing, and they pull some huge fish, like tuna-type fish, on board. And they start cutting them up and putting them over the grill and so Benjamin Franklin was sniffing the aromas, and they kind of appealed to him because he used to eat fish and he was a little hungry and had nothing else to do, I guess, at the time. So he was being seduced by the odors of the cooking fish and being tempted, if you will. And then finally he saw them cutting open a fish, and out of this huge fish came a bunch of smaller fish, which obviously the big fish had eaten earlier. And so Benjamin Franklin said to himself, well, if it's okay for them to eat those small fish, then it must be okay for me to eat the large one. And so he commenced to have a meal with the sailors. And then later, as he was daubing his face there after the meal with a napkin, he chuckled and laughed at his own behavior and said to himself, which he later recorded in his biography, "You know, man is such a reasonable creature. He can find a reason for whatever it is he wishes to do."
Exactly.
So this is the essence of much of our behavior, I think.
Exactly.
Not just in this category either.
Absolutely.
We can produce reasons and excuses for no matter what we intend to do.
Absolutely.
If you had only... You have just a couple of minutes left, and if there's one thought you wanted to leave with our radio audience, what would that be, Colleen?
You know, I think my favorite thing about human beings is that we have the ability to change. We have the ability to transform. We have the ability to evolve and to do things differently once we know better. So, you know, as much as we have the capacity to do things that we that we find distasteful, I think we also have the capacity to be kind and compassionate. And again, like I said, every choice we make makes a difference, and it's up to us whether we want that difference to be negative or positive. So I just ask people to look inside their own hearts and ask themselves if the choices they are making on a daily basis reflect their own values. It's not my values, it's their own values of compassion and kindness.
Well, thank you, Colleen. Again, we want to remind folks that the website is www.compassionatecooks.com. Colleen, we applaud you for the work that you're doing, and with you, we hope for a more compassionate world also for all living creatures.
How about the podcast? We should talk about the podcast.
Oh, yes, right.
Go ahead.
Oh, not just your website, Colleen, but that's where we heard a lot of this interesting information to begin with. Can you put a plug in for yourself there?
Sure. The podcast has been so incredible. I really enjoy doing it. I do a different topic every week, and it just tackles different questions like you're asking today and different myths and some real pragmatic advice, too, about nutrition and food and cooking. So you can find the link to it on CompassionateCooks.com, and you can certainly just go to iTunes or any other podcatcher as well. And just
now, for us who are technologically challenged, what is a podcast? Podcast. Is that something you get off the computer?
Yeah, just think of it as an independently produced radio broadcast. I mean, so you can listen just to individual files on your computer. Like I said, from CompassionateCooks.com, you'll see a button that says Listen to Podcast.
Very good.
And you can listen to files, or you can go to iTunes. And
our students can download them to their iPods and listen to Colleen instead of paying attention in class, for example.
Yes, exactly. Well, that would be very worthwhile.
Probably learn more from Colleen. Thank you so much,
Thank
Colleen.
Thank you.